Hi, I'm Haley.
And I'm Bree.
And this is Calendar of Crime, where each week we examine a case from this week in history. Every year, a disproportionate number of Indigenous women go missing or are found murdered. But due to miscommunications between governing entities and a number of undocumented cases, there's no accurate way to offer statistics on how many of these cases there truly are. Missing and murdered Indigenous women are underreported and underrepresented in the media. According to a study from the National Institute of Justice, more than 4 out of 5 Indigenous women experience some type of violence in their lifetime, which amounts to more than 1.5 million women. These women deserve to have their story told, but even a platform like ours struggles to do so because there's so little information available in the media. So today, we're going to provide as much detail as we can about the disappearance of Ida Beard, because somebody somewhere knows what happened to her, and her family deserves answers. Ida Beard was born on December 26, 1985, in El Reno, Oklahoma, which is about 25 miles west of Oklahoma City. She was Indigenous, an enrolled member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes. Loved ones described Ida as joyful, always with a smile on her face. Ida was a mother of 4. At the time of her disappearance, her kids were 5, 6, 8, and 14.
She was a homebody who never strayed too far from home, where she lived with her mother, Rebecca Punkilla. Rebecca was disabled and depended on her daughter for care. Ida was considered a helpful and giving person who often volunteered at Sunday school. Her cousin, Lorenda Morgan, said in an interview with People magazine that, quote, she wanted to pitch in and do things. Lorenda said that Ida was shy and quiet, but opened up around family. She loved wearing her hair in French braids and often rolled her pant legs up. Lorenda said, quote, as a family member, as her cousin, I knew her to be funny. She always seemed like she was in a good mood and had a happy spirit about her.
It sounds like maybe she was introverted, but more open with her loved ones. And she obviously didn't shy away from helping others.
Yeah, that's the impression I get as well.
On June 30th, 2015, Ida told her mom that she was going to a friend's house a few blocks away. Rebecca hugged her daughter goodbye and Ida left. It was the last time Rebecca ever saw her.
Ida didn't return home that night, and at first, Rebecca thought she may just be out having fun with her friends, but she became concerned as time went on and Ida continued to not return home. It's a little ambiguous as to when Rebecca finally attempted to report her missing. There's not a ton of source material to pull information like exact dates from.
Yeah, you know, totally unimportant information like that.
Yeah, it's pretty disgusting how you can find the exact day a white woman was reported missing easily most of the time. But even after all of our research, we don't know exactly when Rebecca went to the police to report Ida missing. What we do know is that the police didn't initially take the report seriously.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, really unexpected, huh? Instead, the police suggested that she may come back or that she may have chosen to leave town, which wasn't a crime.
What are the police even for?
Yeah, seriously. Because the police were not initially helpful at all, Ida's family members went straight to the community, asking friends and neighbors if they had seen or heard from Ida since her disappearance. Rebecca said, quote, I had no idea, no idea where she was.
That's literally heartbreaking. A mother's worst nightmare.
Yeah, 100%. El Reno police didn't end up actually opening a case on Ida until July 15th, 2015.
Literally 2 weeks after she disappeared.
Correct.
I wish that I could say that I was surprised. Once they filed the report, what investigative steps did they take? Interviews? Searches?
So, you know how we've covered cases where we praise the police because they took action and their actions made sense?
Uh-huh.
This is not one of those. Initially, the police only interviewed 2 people, Rebecca Ponkilla and a friend of Ida's.
And what about canvassing or searching?
I couldn't find anything in the source material to indicate that there has ever been a search conducted specifically to look for Ida.
What the fuck?
That's how I feel about it, too. And it's not just the police. Lorenda and other relatives reached out to media outlets asking them to cover Ida's disappearance, but no one did. Which I can attest to because the lack of information available on this case is downright criminal.
And we all know that public knowledge and media coverage often helps solve cases faster.
Yeah, absolutely. Look at how quickly the Gabby Petito case was resolved after it was literally everywhere.
And that's not to say that we're not happy that her family got closure in that case.
No, not at all. But it shouldn't have to be an either-or situation. The media should have the same type of energy for all missing persons, regardless of clarifiers like race, gender, gender identity, sexual orientation, etc.
Yes, same page, 100%. Lorenda summed up the frustrations with the lack of media coverage perfectly by saying, quote, "If people knew someone was missing from that location, they could call in and give information."
I mean, that's accurate. So what happened next in Ida's case?
I mean, for years, nothing. Additional interviews weren't conducted until years after Ida's disappearance. And I can't even tell you how many years after, because that information is, surprise, not available in the source material. What I can say is that by the time they got around to doing these interviews, the house where Ida was last seen had new tenants and had been renovated.
So basically, any evidence that may have been in that house was long gone by that point.
Exactly. El Reno's assistant police chief, Major Kirk Dickerson, said in 2021, quote, "We are still actively attempting to locate Miss Beard. I hope we find her somewhere sitting in a rocking chair on a front porch somewhere saying, 'I just didn't want to talk to you guys.' Until then, we're going to keep looking for Ida."
So, I mean, to me, that sounds as if they're not really looking for Ida, even still. Like, it sounds like they still have this belief that she willingly disappeared.
Right? That's how I read it, too. He also told People magazine that, quote, "All we know is she was seen leaving, reportedly walking home, and then she never made it there. More likely than not, somebody somewhere knows something. Until those people come forward and share that information with us, it's going to continue to be very difficult to find Ida."
Yeah, that still sounds as if they think she's just hiding out somewhere. Just for a second, can you imagine if a white woman with four kids who spent her free time helping out at Sunday school and caring for her disabled mother went to a friend's house and never came home, what the police would be saying 7 years later?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I can't picture any scenario where they'd be like, "Well, maybe one of these days we'll find out where she is."
That fills me with so much rage.
That is the correct reaction. Lorenda had stated that she didn't feel like Ida's case was thoroughly investigated.
Yes, I concur 100%.
And she said that law enforcement in El Reno have never received any substantial leads in her case.
Well, it probably doesn't help that their investigation has been shit. Ida's family has had a really rough time in the years since Ida went missing. She was very close to her younger sister, Zena Deer, who told the Oklahoman that, quote, "We really fell into depression over the years where we would sleep all day. We wouldn't get up to eat sometimes."
I can't even imagine.
Me either. The family says they wait nervously anytime they hear that a body has been found, wondering if it's Ida. But Zena also said that she keeps strong through hope and faith, adding that, quote, "Because hope gives me some kind of joy, knowing that maybe she'll come back. My faith in knowing what happened happened, and I believe I'll see her again."
In the years since Ida's disappearance, she became a grandmother when her oldest daughter had a child. It's possible, maybe even probable, that that child will never get to meet Ida. Ida's mother said that, quote, "We won't stop looking and waiting for her to come through the door until we know what really happened to her."
They must feel so helpless.
Yeah, absolutely. But Lorenda used her cousin's disappearance as a catalyst for action. In 2018, 3 years after Ida's disappearance, she began working with State Representative Mickey Dolenz and State Senator Paul Rosino to create legislation that would be called Ida's Law. SB 172, Ida's Law, was signed by the governor of Oklahoma, Kevin Stitt, on April 20th, 2020, and went into effect on November 1st of the same year.
Okay, break it down for me. What does Ida's Law do?
The bill creates an Office of the Liaison for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Persons within the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigations to facilitate state, tribal, and federal law enforcement communication and to focus on solving open cases. Senator Paul Rosino said about the bill, quote, "One of the obstacles solving these cases is the uncertainty about jurisdiction between states, federal, and tribal law enforcement. This misunderstanding over who's responsible for an investigation can cause so many of these people to fall right through the cracks. These families want to know what's happened to their family members, and we should be doing all we can to try to find them.
This office should, in theory, remove the confusion for Indigenous families regarding who they should report their loved one missing to. But why is there so much confusion in the first place?
It's a combination of factors, but the short of it is that tribal courts don't have the jurisdiction to prosecute non-natives. And depending on whether the missing person is native or not, and whether they went missing from native lands or non-native lands, there's a different process for each.
Resolving that is super important because the jurisdiction thing is a big issue in cases of missing and murdered Indigenous people. When it's not clear who you're supposed to make a report to, or officials refuse to take your report because of jurisdictional confusion, you lose time.
Right, and when someone is missing, time is everything. It's important for law enforcement to be able to react right away to these cases, rather than letting the report sit for 2 weeks like they did to Ida. The office was also tasked with creating a database to track cases and to provide guidance for victims' families.
I feel like guidance is super important to try to facilitate trust.
Exactly. After the bill was signed, Lorenda called Ida's mom immediately. She said, quote, "I told her, I wanted you to know that Ida's life mattered, because my aunt felt like nobody cared that Ida was missing. Me and my cousins, after it was all over, we all cried. We were like, gosh, Ida would be like, what? Me? I have a law named after me?"
It must have felt cathartic in a way, and also like they were at least able to do something, even if Ida's case didn't receive the attention it deserved. Now her name is out there at least.
Definitely. Unfortunately, the signing of the bill doesn't necessarily guarantee its implementation.
Wait, how is that not how it works?
Well, lawmakers didn't direct state funding towards the Office of Liaison Expansion, meaning that the OSBI had to rely on tribes and federal grants to fund support employees.
So the very people who are suffering because of the jurisdictional confusion and the lack of support are also expected in part to financially support the solution? That's pretty backwards.
I agree wholeheartedly. In 2021, OSBI stated that they plan to launch a department dedicated to investigating crimes against tribal members and providing support to families of the victims. They did assign two employees to work on cases part-time under Ida's law while waiting for funding. OSBI Special Agent Dale Fine, a member of the Cherokee Nation and an OSBI agent for 9 years at the time, was appointed the tribal liaison. Fine is responsible for compiling a list of open, unsolved cases of murdered and missing Indigenous peoples. And within the first few months of his assignment, he identified a few dozen cases, which are now being investigated between the OSBI, local law enforcement, and tribal law enforcement.
The other employee is Christy Potta, who is a support advocate at OSBI for families of victims, providing updates about the case, locating and recommending support groups, securing funding for funeral costs, and providing support in legal hearings. She and Fine are tasked together with gaining the trust of the 39 tribal nations in Oklahoma and finding a way to bridge the trust between these tribes and local law enforcement.
I certainly don't think that's going to be an easy task, given the way that things have played out historically.
No, it's really not. On that topic, Potta said, quote, "It's a trust issue. They don't automatically believe their case is going to be looked at the same as a non-native case."
Again, historically, that's correct.
Right? And even Potta herself has reported that in her travels throughout the state, she has heard prejudiced comments made about Indigenous peoples by those responsible for investigating their cases.
The trust issues that Indigenous people face in going to local law enforcement is absolutely understandable. The lack of support from local law enforcement, unfortunately, isn't unique to this case either. Due to the overwhelming amount of jurisdictional confusion, it often ends up that when someone from the Native community goes missing, family and friends end up contributing most of the search efforts.
Right, which is awful. Not only are the family and friends already going through something traumatic, but the system by which they're supposed to solve the issue continues to re-traumatize them.
There are groups aimed at helping close this gap, like Matriarch, which is a nonprofit in Oklahoma City and Tulsa that supports social welfare within tribes for Indigenous women and children. In 2020, they helped organize searches for three missing Indigenous girls that were eventually located.
Sounds like the police could take some notes.
Right? Matriarch's co-founder, Sarah Adams Cornell, said, quote, "It should not be up to the community and family members to solely search for their loved ones. I'm hopeful that this office is going to help bridge a lot of those gaps."
There's also Northeastern Oklahoma Indigenous Safety and Education, or NOISE, which focuses on helping the Indigenous community. Their work surrounds helping the families of missing and murdered Indigenous peoples and helping victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and sex trafficking through support and awareness.
Trent Shores, a Choctaw citizen and former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Oklahoma, has estimated that there are between 60 and 70 missing Indigenous people in Oklahoma alone. Shores said, quote, "What we found was there were discrepancies among various reporting agencies," referring to tribal and state reporting and NAMIS, the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. Some cases were overreported while others unreported, and he even referenced a case where someone was still being reported missing after being found.
The police have it sounding like rocket science to accomplish the same jobs they do for everyone else.
Right, and it really doesn't need to be. Olivia Gray, chair of the board of directors for NOISE, said, quote, "So laws could help. It would depend on the law. Having a liaison still doesn't help us get people found, and it still doesn't bring justice for murdered people."
I can absolutely see where she's coming from. And realistically, there have been efforts in the past that took longer than expected to start to gain traction, and I think being effective is the most important part.
In 2020, there were actually two other federal-level laws created to address the disappearances within the Native community and to help understand the extent of the murdered and missing Indigenous peoples. They were called Savannah's Act and the Not Invisible Act.
I want to give a brief summary of Savannah's Act for context, but we will be covering this case more in depth in the future. The act was named after Savannah Graywind, a 22-year-old woman who belonged to the Spirit Lake Sioux tribe. In August of 2017, she was 8 months pregnant with her first child. After going to the apartment of her upstairs neighbor, she disappeared. Police were contacted that followed up multiple times until they found her baby with the upstairs neighbor 3 days after her disappearance. 8 days later, her body was found in the Red River. She had been brutally murdered by the upstairs neighbor whose motive was to steal her child and pass it off as her own.
That is depraved and legitimately sickening.
Yeah, it's fucking vile. So, in her honor, the act was named after her. It clarified the responsibilities of federal, state, tribal, and local law enforcement, the goal being to increase the communication and coordination between agencies so that cases are not missed and officials respond effectively. Savannah's Act also required tribal consultations on how to improve tribal data relevance and access to databases.
But coordination after a crime has taken place isn't nearly as effective as prevention. The Not Invisible Act was meant to increase coordination between government entities to combat violent crime against natives before it happens.
Both of these bills failed to meet their initial deadlines, which affected their ability to be funded, resulting in delays.
What were the requirements to be funded?
Requirements in Savannah's Act were to the effect that the U.S. Attorney General would develop a strategy to educate the public about NAMIS, conduct outreach to tribes, and create a procedure for responding to missing and murdered Indigenous peoples. And the Not Invisible Act required a joint Department of Justice and Department of the Interior Commission to develop recommendations for how the federal government can track and report data on murdered and missing Indigenous persons and trafficking in order to combat the rates of violent crimes against natives. The two entities were required to establish the commission and appoint all its members, which was not completed by their respective deadlines.
The Department of Justice and the Department of the Interior Commission had months to make progress on these, but missed several deadlines before the Government Accountability Office did a report showing their progress step by step and providing recommendations. They have since announced ongoing implementation measures for both laws.
We really wish there was a more positive outlook to reference, but the truth is, this is an ongoing issue that requires intervention. The media doesn't cover missing and murdered Indigenous women's cases anywhere near as often as they happen, leading the public to know little about the severity of the situation. The lack of a centralized database for missing persons between agencies also contributes to confusion and takes the focus off of the victims.
Today, a new detective is working on Ida's case. Her cousin, Lorenda, said, quote, "He wants to find Ida. He wants to find out what happened to her. He's really passionate about it." We sincerely hope that the continued efforts to curb disproportionate violence against natives can be changed with the implementation of these laws. Ida Beard has been missing since June 30, 2015, from El Reno, Oklahoma. At the time of her disappearance, she had brown hair and brown eyes and weighed 120 pounds. Ida is 5 feet 6 inches tall and would be 36 years old today. If you have any information about Ida's disappearance, please contact the El Reno Police Department at 405-295-9399.
For all details and sources regarding this case, you can check the show notes or go to our website, calendarofcrime.com. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Calendar of Crime, and we'll be back next week with a brand new case from That Week in History.